I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. There was another mass shooting last night, this time in Tulsa, Oklahoma, when a gunman killed four people before reportedly turning the gun on himself. This happened as families in Uvalde, Texas, are holding funeral services for the 19 children and two teachers gunned down at Robb Elementary School last week. And that massacre happened a week after a gunman killed 10 shoppers at a Black Run grocery store in Buffalo, New York. While mass shootings get national attention, shootings in cities like Philadelphia are an everyday occurrence and get less coverage. In 2020, guns became the main cause of death for young children and teenagers, surpassing car accidents. There are 400 million firearms in the U.S., more guns than people, as the manufacture of guns have tripled in the last 20 years, driven obviously by demand. What's behind the surge in gun ownership, our obsession with guns, and the hyper-partisan debate over firearms? Are there regulations at work that will make us safer? Or do we have to learn to live and die with this level of gun violence? We have two guests. Michael Siegel is visiting professor in the Department of Public Health and Community Medicine at Tufts University School of Medicine. He studies the impact of gun policies on gun violence. Michael Siegel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And also with us is Chad Kautzer. He's associate professor of philosophy at Lehigh University, currently writing a book about the militarization of gun culture, the threat it poses to democratic norms and institutions. Chad Kautzer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's good to be with you.
Thank you. You're very welcome, and nice to have both of you with us. Let me just make sure our listeners can join us, because obviously with such an important discussion, we want to make sure that we can hear from you. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I think I feel like a lot of people just so angry and frustrated. We seem to be stuck in this cycle of gun violence. We hear about thoughts and prayers. We hear the grief and the outrage. And then we see the paralysis on a national level when everyone sort of goes into their predictable corners to fight about what to do about this. Michael, are we just doomed to live with this level of violence?
We're not. We're absolutely not. Because there are solutions out there that are available, and we're just choosing not to implement them. My research has shown that there are a package of four laws that, if enacted, based on our research, could reduce firearm homicide by 35%. It's about one-third. And those are permit requirements, universal background checks, laws that prevent people who have a history of violence from obtaining guns, and red flag laws, which allow guns to be confiscated from people who are judged to be at risk, either to harm themselves or others. And so the we're not doomed to live with this if we, our politicians, develop the courage to stand up to the National Rifle Association. I mean, basically, if 10 Republicans in the Senate were willing to stand up against the NRA and vote for these laws, we would see change.
Well, let me get you in the conversation, Chad, and a variation on that same question, but also picking up on what Michael Siegel just said. If there are things that can be done and we don't do them, what does that say about America?
It says we have a problem, and it's a longstanding problem. I absolutely agree with what Michael said. There are measures, we can identify them, and if we implement them, they will reduce gun violence and gun deaths. What my work focuses on is the cultural reasons why politicians don't act on them, and why, even though these policies are popular among Americans, they don't translate into legislation. And so I think there are some political forces, types of political identity that are inhibiting what people call common sense or sensible gun reforms. And even more so in my work, I'm also concerned about democracy itself. So gun culture certainly poses a threat to public health and individual safety, but the type of gun culture we've developed in the United States is a threat to democracy as well. And so I think harm reduction, we can think in both political and physical terms here.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things. And I should say to our listeners, Chad, you have owned guns, you have shotguns, so you're speaking from your own personal perspective. But it feels as if something has changed, something about gun culture in the United States. Back in decades ago, the NRA was about gun responsibility. It wasn't about trying to figure out how to sell as many guns as possible in the United States. What changed and when?
That's a great question. I will try to give you the short version of that. There are some great works that give you the long version, books out there that track that history and the changes in the NRA. The NRA was founded as an organization to improve the skills of soldiers or civilians in order to prepare them for war. Because during the Civil War, the Union thought that the soldiers could very much improve their marksmanship, and the NRA formed in order to do that. It was formed by Union generals in New York, and for a good part of its history, it focused on training, marksmanship. It expanded into shooting sports and hunting, and was open to gun reform. It did oppose some, but it was political to some degree, but it wasn't until the 60s and certainly the 70s that it became a pretty hardline partisan organization. And the decisive moment of that shift to a kind of hardline political organization was in 1977, when there was a coup through an all-night meeting at the annual convention of the NRA. Some hardliners and activists took over the organization, led by Harlan Carter, who then became its most significant leader, I would argue, in the NRA history. And when Carter took over in 77, he said, no more gun regulation. We have an absolute position. We'll oppose it all the way. And Carter himself has quite a checkered past. He was in his teens, he was convicted of murder. He killed a 15-year-old Mexican-American boy in his town with a shotgun blast to the chest, was let off on a technicality, and then changed his name before he enrolled in college to conceal that history. Harlan Carter then went on to lead the U.S. Border Patrol and its infamous Operation Wetback in 1954.
Right. Under Eisenhower, that was.
Yes, exactly. And that was a full militarized deportation process run by him. And then he took over the NRA. Mm. and so border politics have often been part of the NRA since 77. And after that period, they became very partisan, very political, and very, I would say, reactionary.
Well, Michael, is the problem the NRA from your perspective?
I would say that the problem is really the politicians who refuse to stand up to the NRA. The NRA wouldn't be a problem if politicians would actually vote in the public's interest rather than worry about, political identity and their party and preserving their party. I think Professor Coucher is exactly right when he says that this is really a threat to democracy. I mean, in a democracy, when the majority of people support a policy, you would think that policy should be passed. And the fact that we have overwhelming support for these policies, in fact, the four policies that I mentioned that I believe would be incredibly effective reducing firearm violence, all four of those policies are strongly supported by gun owners. In fact, we looked in particular at Republican gun owners and found that a majority of Republican gun owners support all of those laws. So there is no excuse that politicians can make and say, well, I have to vote against this because my constituents won't support this. That's not true. That's a myth. And the NRA has really succeeded, I think, in creating a myth that this is a divided and controversial issue, They want us to think that, you know, there's two types of people in this world, gun owners and non-gun owners. And the reality is, based on our surveys, the majority of gun owners don't even identify as gun owners. They're people who typically have a gun for self-defense, and that's really it. They don't even use the guns, the majority gun owners. And they support basic common sense policies. So the only one who these Republicans are really protecting is the NRA. I mean, and they're really showing political cowardice by not being willing to stand up to the NRA.
Well, Michael, let me just stop you there. If there's that much support for the things that you describe, for background checks, red flag laws, and the like, then why do these politicians who oppose all of that, why don't they lose their job? Why are they not elected out of office, tossed out of office, I should say?
Well, I think that part of the reason is that the NRA has been incredibly effective at mobilizing its constituents, its members. And not only that, but in making its members one-issue voters. In other words, they've been successful in spreading the mantra that any gun legislation that is passed is simply, you know, one step on the way to taking guns away from everyone, and that this is the most important threat to freedom that we face in our country. And because these are one-issue voters, they're able to threaten specific members of Congress by saying, you know, hey, by fighting them on that one issue, and their members respond. I think, however, that we're seeing that can actually backfire, that with enough mobilization and enough political will, we can defeat the NRA.
We're almost at a break here, but Chad, to you, the NRA, as I understand it, has something like 5 million members. We're a country of, 300 million plus people. In a nutshell, what gives them that kind of power?
The NRA has been very effective, and Michael already touched upon this, at cultivating a certain kind of political identity, not just an identity, a politicized identity. And one of the threats to democracy that I am most concerned about is that identity is built on an opposition, and at its center is fear and violence. Mm. So it is constantly telling its membership that they are the defenders of freedom, and that there are forces that hate them, want to destroy them. They talk about cleansing and genocide. And so the way that you cultivate the kind of motivation and single-issue voting that Michael just talked about is by cultivating a deep political identity that makes people fearful of any kind of change and gets them highly activated to contact their representatives, to lobby, to show up at meetings, and certainly to turn out at the polls. And so even though they're a minority among gun owners, they are very effective at turning people out to have their voices heard.
A very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about the crisis of gun violence in America. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and today on the show, we're talking about the crisis of gun violence in America. What would make us safer? And do we have the political will to take those steps to make us safer? And we have been talking about the NRA with our guests, Michael Siegel, visiting professor in the Department of Public Health and Community Medicine at Tufts University School of Medicine. He studies the impact of gun policies on gun violence. Also with us, Chad Kautzer. He's associate professor of philosophy at Lehigh University. He's writing a book about the militarization of gun culture and the threat he says it poses to democratic norms and institutions. We have been talking about the NRA. Let me play a clip that goes back to 1997. This is Charlton Heston speaking before the National Press Club on September 11th, 1997, arguing that the Second Amendment is the most important of all amendments, including the Bill of Rights.
Today, I want to talk to you about guns. Why we have them, why the Bill of Rights guarantees that we can have them, and why my right to have a gun is more important than your right to rail against it in the press. I believe every good journalist needs to know why the Second Amendment must be considered more essential than the First Amendment. This may be a bitter pill to swallow, but the right to keep and bear arms is not archaic. It's not an outdated, dusty idea some old dead white guys dreamed up in fear of the redcoats. No. It's just as essential to liberty today as it was in 1776.
Michael, and as true as in 2022?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the rhetoric that the NRA has been spouting ever since around 1977, after this coup took place. They are spouting this rhetoric. They even have a publication for their NRA members, which is called America's First Freedom. And basically, the whole point of that magazine is arguing that, you know, the right to own a gun is the most fundamental freedom in our society. But the problem is that the reality is that most gun owners don't believe that. We actually just completed a survey in which we found that 70% of gun owners do not believe that the Second Amendment is absolute.
Huh, interesting.
So and see that there are limitations to the Second Amendment, and in fact, they support limiting gun rights for people who have a history of violence or who are at high risk for violence to the level of about 80%. So the reality is that the NRA is not representing gun owners in America. They are not. They're representing their own, their own personal, not personal, but really this identity, this political identity that they're trying to promote, essentially to sell guns. And so because they're not representing gun owners, one of the problems we have is that we essentially have a silent majority, the majority of gun owners who are unwilling to speak out publicly. In fact, in our survey, we found that most gun owners believe that they're in the minority. They don't believe that they're typical. And so I think one of the things that needs to happen is just public education. We need to dispel the myths that the NRA has been spouting. And people need to understand that the majority of gun owners do support these laws. Another finding, which was really interesting, was that gun owners who believe that other gun owners are not supportive of these laws are less likely to support those laws. So simply the perception that the NRA has created, that we have this divide between gun owners and non-gun owners, is, I think, critical to their success. The truth is that this is really one of the least controversial issues that I've worked on. I have never worked on a public health issue where 70 to 80% of the public supports the laws that I've been promoting. And so it's a real tragedy that despite these high levels of public support, these measures are being blocked.
Jeff, let me go back to you. And you mentioned the kind of gun culture that has grown up in the last couple of decades. And obviously, we're seeing also more lethal weaponry with assault style firearms or assault style weapons. You know, help us understand, I guess, and we should say, obviously, most people who own guns are not engaging in mass violence or even shooting other people. So we'll just, you know, put it out there. But nonetheless, when we learn about who these shooters are, they seem like they are disaffected young men with a grudge, who are often lonely, who have what appeared to be, at least from the outside, kind of dysfunctional family relationships, often alone, sometimes bullied. What does a gun mean to someone like that?
That's a great question. Let me try to address it in two parts. Right. And the first is just the some of the trends that we've witnessed over the last couple of decades. One is militarization. And by that, I mean the introduction and distribution of military-grade weaponry among the population, among private citizens. This means increased lethality, and with it comes certain ideological notions of being a warrior, being a soldier, being at war, on a war footing. So you get a kind of war framing of gun culture when you flood the population with military-style weapons. The militarization is also happening among law enforcement, and this is often overlooked in gun studies and discussions of gun culture is the gun culture. There is a gun culture in law enforcement, and that has become militarized slowly, starting maybe in the 50s, but really increased in the 60s and 70s, and has been fast-tracked since then. And part of that is the U.S. Department of Defense basically dumping surplus military equipment into police forces.
Yeah, we saw that in Ferguson, right?
Yeah, exactly. You get the creation of tactical units in almost every law enforcement division. Almost every SWAT team in every police department is now routinely carrying out warrants for drug arrests, small-level crime. The first SWAT used in 1969 was against the Black Panther office in Los Angeles. So you have this militarization that's going on the border among law enforcement generally and among the private civilians or private citizens. And then you have, as you described, I think quite well, these conditions of crisis, alienation, and you have troubled people, not mentally ill, just troubled. We're all troubled at some point in our lives. The worst thing we can do is have at our immediate disposal tools that can take our life or the lives of others when we're in a moment of crisis. And so what's happened from this inundation of weapons is that those tools have become way too accessible to too many people in too many places and magnified those crises into public tragedies.
Well, and Michael, we're learning about a couple of the more recent shooters, you know, turning 18, going into a store, buying an AR, buying lots of ammunition. I'm assuming in the military, when you use a military-style weapon, you are trained to use it. You know, you learn how it works, but a young person or any person can largely walk into a store and walk out with a military-style weapon.
Exactly. And I think Chad said the key word, which is accessibility. You know, there are mental health issues. There are people are feeling, you know, disempowered and, sure. and disgruntled. Everywhere in the world, the United States is not the only place where we have, you know, 18-year-olds who are feeling lonely and disgruntled. However, the United States is the only place in the world where those people commit these heinous mass shootings. And why is that? It's not because, you know, the mental stress or loneliness or depression is unique to America. It's because the accessibility of guns is unique to America. And that's why I think we found that these four laws that I mentioned, and what ties these laws together is they make guns inaccessible or less accessible to people who are at the highest risk for violence. And that's why those laws are effective.
Because it focuses on the person, right, not the weapon?
Exactly. It's you know, we're not going to get rid of 400 million weapons.
Right.
You know, it's just not feasible. It's not going to happen. So the only thing we can really do is to control who has access to those weapons. I mean, a good example are our machine guns. People probably don't realize this, but you can buy a machine gun. Civilians can obtain machine guns. However, it's regulated under the National Firearms Act, which is a very different act than what regulates civilian firearms or non-automatic weapons. And we don't have a problem with machine gun, you know, homicides. You don't see people going out with machine guns. And the reason for that is not because the machine guns are less lethal. Obviously, they're much more lethal.
Right.
They truly are weapons of war. The reason we don't have machine gun killings is because they're not as accessible. You can't just go to a store. An 18-year-old can't just walk into a store and say, oh, you know, let me have a machine gun. But an 18-year-old can walk into a store and say, let me have an assault rifle.
Here's a comment from Trish, and I'll toss this to you, Chad. She says, please stop calling it gun culture. It's a gun cult. Art, food, music, clothing, that's part of culture. Are we talking about a cult more than culture? It's an interesting point. Thanks,
yeah,
Trish.
No, I'm glad someone pushed back with that, because I should have prefaced by saying there are many gun cultures. Of course. And as you mentioned, Marty, I grew up in a gun culture. It was more of a hunting culture. There was certainly a you know, collector culture. It wasn't highly politicized, you know, that's not really what we're talking about today. When I talk about gun culture, you know, maybe you could talk about it in cultish sense, insofar as there is the cultivation of a very particular kind of political identity. And that one, as I hope I said previously, is not shared by all gun owners by any means, and in these different gun cultures. But I would like to make one more point about that identity, because it came up in the Charlton Heston clip that you played, which I think is so important, is he made the argument that gun ownership is essential to liberty. And this, I think, is what makes the this kind of vigilante political identity that has been shopped by the NRA for many decades now so powerful, is it's telling its members that they are the protectors of the Constitution. They are the defenders of the country just by owning a gun, that they somehow become warriors in defense of this storied tradition we call the United States and its political culture, and they are the defenders of that. And so this notion that I'm not just defending my right to have a gun or a particular cultural practice, but I'm defending the nation itself, liberty itself. If that is your identity, no amount of amazing research done by folks like Michael is going to convince you to change your mind.
Because it's your identity. I mean, that you are literally in your own mind fighting for your country.
Because it's about freedom and it's not about harm, right? If you believe that there must be sacrifices to defend freedom, it's collateral damage. And so, you know, in 1970, Richard Hofstadter, a famous American historian, wrote and coined the term gun culture in an article called America as a Gun Culture. And he ended that article by saying, you know, how many tragic deaths will it take for us to change our minds? He literally ended the piece with, how far must things go? And I think we've seen just in the last 2 weeks that there is no limit to the amount of carnage. It will never convince those who think that they're fighting for freedom, right? And so I think that's really important to understand that we have to present the data and research that Michael is doing, but we also have to target, critique, and understand the political identities that are motivating these actors.
And Michael, it's often common, or it is common after a mass shooting, that there's then a run on gun people wanting to go out and buy guns. Maybe the fear that they're going to take our guns away, which is obviously not going to happen here in the United States, but there is a sort of perverse incentive, it seems.
Well, the gun manufacturers and the NRA have been very effective at using this fear to motivate gun sales. And in fact, it's kind of ironic, because when President Trump was president, we actually saw somewhat of a decline in gun sales, whereas when President Obama was running, we saw a huge increase. And the NRA, the gun lobby, has and the manufacturers have mobilized fear that, you know, if Democrats get in office or liberals get in office, they're going to take away everyone's guns to effectively sell these weapons. And I think that what the public, again, needs to realize, and what really needs to be publicized, is that this, you know, toxic aspect of gun culture really is only a very small percent of gun owners. We asked an interesting question on our survey of gun owners, and we said, do you view yourself as a gun owner? Do you identify as a gun owner? And interestingly, only 12% of gun owners said that they identify as gun owners. In other words, if, you know, I happen to own a home security system, but I don't view myself as a home security system owner. There's no identity associated with that. Right, I don't go on a website every day of home security owners, but this 12% of gun owners who do identify do that. But that's a minority. 88% basically just this is a consumer tool that they use. It's a consumer product that they're using for self defense. And we have, as Chad said, you know, there are multiple gun cultures And some of those gun cultures are healthy, you know, hunting and collecting and the tradition of guns. But the problem is that as those aspects of gun culture have declined, the gun manufacturers and the NRA have had to find a way to sell their weapons. And so they've done that by creating this more toxic culture. And it was done for financial reasons, ultimately. They couldn't sell their weapons. Hunting is just, there's only so much money you can make when in a country where we're losing our grounds for our hunting and people's interest in sport shooting is declining. And so for financial reasons, it was brilliant. The NRA and the gun manufacturers basically decided, hey, let's create a new use for guns. And they did that by using racialized fear to scare people into the need for guns for self-defense and by scaring people that guns are going to be taken away.
And Chad, we're almost up on a break once again, but nonetheless, I'm thinking of those Christmas cards that came out in the last couple of Christmases of families, you know, holding all their guns, and that is part of their Merry Christmas card. What does that indicate?
Yeah, that's the blending of different cultures, right? There's certainly a family, Christianity, often a kind of white identity, and gun culture. And so this is a kind of normalizing process by bringing in what some people would find totally inappropriate to a moment, and giving it, in a sense, a cover of normalcy and tradition. And I think it's pernicious. It's very pernicious. But I do hope we get to talk more about the racialized fear involved in self-defense. I think that's a really important point that Michael brought up.
Yeah, indeed. And I do want to do that. And a quick reintroduction, that's Chad Kautzer, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Lehigh University, Michael Siegel, Visiting Professor in the Department of Public Health and Community Medicine at Tufts University School of Medicine. We are talking about the problem of gun violence in America. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Chad Kautzer and Michael Siegel about the problem of gun violence in America and what to do about it. Let me just play one more clip, and this is from last week's NRA convention in Houston. We'll first hear from former President Trump and then from Texas Senator Ted Cruz.
The existence of evil in our world is not a reason to disarm law-abiding citizens who know how to use their weapon and can protect a lot of people. The existence of evil is one of the very best reasons to arm law-abiding citizens.
We must not react to evil and tragedy by abandoning the Constitution or infringing on the rights of our law-abiding citizens.
Let me turn to you, Michael. Then I do want to talk about this racialized fear, but I'm thinking about that, you know, the tragedy in Uvalde, Texas, where those children were gunned down and just the horror of what happened. But what we saw with law enforcement and the support around that school, what happened when so-called good guys had guns, they were unable to prevent this massacre.
There is really very little evidence that the so-called good guys with guns are what is going to protect us. What really is going to protect us is keeping guns out of the hands of people who are at high risk for violence. And the statement that both Trump and Cruz made was kind of idiotic, frankly, because none of these laws that I'm talking about that actually would reduce accessibility for people who are at high risk for violence to get guns, none of them disarm law-abiding citizens. None of them infringe upon gun rights. And in fact, they're actually helping to preserve gun rights, because what they're doing is basically making sure that when someone buys a gun, that they are not at high risk for violence. They don't have a criminal history, for example, especially a history of violence. And so that's actually preserving the rights of law-abiding citizens to obtain guns, because it ensures that if you don't have a criminal history, you can access guns. Hmm. So, you know, ironically, and this kind of gets into the racialized fear aspect or the racialized aspect of gun control. What's really ironic is that despite all the NRA's complaints and Trump and Cruz and all their complaints about the infringement of gun rights, it's not these proposed laws that are going to infringe upon gun rights. We have a long history of infringement of the Second Amendment in this country that neither Trump nor Cruz nor the NRA wants to talk about or has ever talked about. And that history of infringement is basically laws that have kept guns away from African Americans systematically. Right. The only real infringement of gun rights that has occurred in this country has been keeping guns out of the hands of African Americans simply because of race and simply because of the desire for white hegemony, white control.
Well, Chad, as Michael was talking, I scribbled black guy with a gun, right?
Black guy with a gun, you said? Yeah. Actually, when he was speaking, I was thinking of Philando Castile, who was shot and killed by police in 2016 in Minneapolis. It's a pretty stark example of the contradictions at the heart of the NRA message about law-abiding gun owners. Castile had a permit for concealed carry. He was part of a traffic stop. The police pulled over the car that his girlfriend was driving and asked for registration, which was in the glove box, which is where Castile's gun was. And so he notified the police officer that there was a gun, that he had a permit to carry it. Mm. And the police officer saw a black man talking about a gun, screamed, "Don't go for it, don't go for it," and then unloaded his revolver into Philando Castile. And there was not a peep from the NRA or other gun advocacy groups. And so this is the two sides of the coin here on gun rights and political identity. The political identity I've been talking about has a shade, has a color, and it is part of the history of this country is injustice in the treatment of those using firearms, the victim of firearms among communities of color versus those in white communities who use those arms, often illegally. It's a tradition that we have to confront, and it's a tradition that haunts the NRA because they are radically inconsistent in their application of critiques of law-abiding gun owners.
Let me read some more comments. We have a lot of them. One from Mark. He suggests, why not levy state taxes on gun purchases and use that as a way to, I guess, institute safety initiatives. Michael says, regarding red flag laws, I worry about the lack of due process after having been through this myself. Michael, we'll get back to that. An email from Anita. I find it strange that the Republicans stand on abortion as saving lives, but when it comes to some kind of gun control, which is killing children who are walking on this earth, they take a very different stance. A comment from Kate, can't say this enough. The reason nothing happens with gun policy is that the NRA contributes big bucks to politicians' campaigns. Let me just pick up, and Michael, I'll put Michael's comment about red flag laws, because you said this is something that actually can help reduce gun violence. His concern, Michael, our listener, about due process. Is there a way to just make sure that people do get due process when there are red flag laws?
Well, absolutely. And in fact, in our survey of gun owners, we found that when you just ask gun owners, you know, do you support red flag laws? There's about 70% support. But when you specify, do you support red flag laws that contain a due process clause that requires due process before permanent confiscation of guns, it actually rises to above 80%. And so most red flag laws that have passed state legislatures do have very, very carefully designed due process procedures. In most cases, there is a court hearing that's required at which the subject of the order is allowed to present evidence. They're allowed to, you know, make the argument for why they're not a danger, and so there is due process in these laws, or there should be. Every red flag law should contain these kinds of processes. But just the reality with red flag laws is that it's very rare for these laws to be contested. In most of the overwhelming number of cases where this happens, the person whose gun is taken away is actually happy. They're actually relieved because they may be suicidal in many cases, and when the gun is taken away, they, you know, it's almost a sigh of relief for them. So the reality is that these laws are they do contain due process. They're overwhelmingly supported by gun owners. But I do agree with Michael completely that they should contain clauses that ensure due process.
Sure. Indeed. You know, Chad, one of our listeners mentioned abortion, and I was thinking about this today. If we had the same kind of restrictions on guns that we have on abortions, it would be interesting to, for instance, waiting periods, you know, so-called cooling off periods for guns, whether that would make a dent when it came to gun violence.
Of course. Yeah.
I mean, not that it's going to happen. I understand. Certainly not in the reality that we are in today.
Yeah. I think, you know, that Charlton Heston clip that you played, he goes on in that to National Press Club speech where he the whole time derides the press.
Yes.
But one thing he
says.
Know
your audience, in there is, right? Yeah.
Yeah. He says in that speech, he says, you know, the founders were pretty wise about human nature, that we are can be vengeful, that we can be passionate, that we can be cruel, we can be violent, etc. And basically what he was trying to get at is that the Second Amendment is to control the rise of tyranny and the vengefulness against the people, etc. But there is truth in the fact that we are unpredictable, emotional creatures who go through crises and have difficult times. And we do better and are more secure and are safer if we have a community and institutions who will look out for us and take care of us. And so we need each other. I'm making this as a not just a point about a waiting period, a cooling off period, but in general, the notion of security at the heart of the political identity that groups like the NRA are promoting completely disregard our reliance on others for our own safety and even our own freedom. We need each other. And so we need to look after each other in times of crisis, not give each other the opportunity to act rashly and self-destructively. And so, yeah, I think cooling off periods make sense. But also, you know, the institutions and practices that will look after people who are in crisis make a lot of sense too. And so it's not just gun laws versus non-gun or, you know, no gun law, but what kind of communities do we want to live in? How do we want to capacitate them to take care of each other in times of crisis? Because we all have times of crisis.
I'm just letting that sit in because I think it's so powerful. Here's a question from Ronald. This goes to you, Michael Siegel. He says, in your guest list of four gun regulation recommendations, I do not hear mention of limitations on automatic military-style weapons, high-volume magazines. Please comment. And if I can just add something, there was a 10-year assault weapons ban, began under Clinton, and then it ran out under Bush. Any takeaway from that? And I'm curious about your response to Ronald's question there.
Well, it's an interesting question, and, you know, certainly when I first, you know, thought about assault weapons ban, my first reaction was, yeah, why should these weapons be on the market? The reality, though, is when you look at the actual way in which assault weapons are defined, it really comes down to what are essentially cosmetic features of the gun, and features that don't actually affect the speed at which you can fire the gun or the lethality. And the research shows, and, you know, I'm in public health, I'm a researcher, and so I'm swayed by research evidence more than by just, you know, the feeling that seeing this black color gun, you know, is scary. The research shows that these laws just aren't effective. We did a study that was published last year which showed that states that have assault weapons bans do not see a reduction in mass shooting incidents. And the reason for that is simple. It's that you don't need an assault weapon to commit mass shooting. You know, the shooter in Tulsa yesterday apparently went into the hospital with a rifle and a shotgun. The killer in Virginia Tech, who killed, I think it was around 50 people in that college, simply had handguns. You know, if you have a handgun that has 30 rounds, 30-round magazine, you can do an incredible amount of damage in a short period of time. So, you know, the reality is that these perpetrators are going to find another weapon. They're not going to go into a store, not be able to buy an assault weapon, and then say, okay, well, I'm going to give up. You know, if they can obtain a weapon, you're not going to stop that crime from being committed. And so I think there needs to be less of a focus on the type of weapon as on who obtains that weapon. You know, an 18-year-old shouldn't be able to go and buy an assault weapon, period. And so if we pass laws that reduce the accessibility to these weapons rather than focusing on, you know, what, you know, somehow we can change the lethality of the gun stock out there, I think we'll be more successful.
Let me read a comment from Linda, and then I do want to talk about the Heller decision, and the U.S. Supreme Court is going to be ruling on a open carry law in New York. An email from Linda: the media, including Radio Times, helps the NRA by saying politician instead of Republican. People feel helpless because they think it's everyone in office. In actuality, we are only two Democratic senators away. I understand what you're saying there, Linda. I think it's a little more complicated than that, but I'll just put it out there for everybody. But let me ask you, Chad, in the Heller decision, Scalia wrote it and basically said there is this individual right to bear arms, looking at the Second Amendment. Now we've got a U.S. Supreme Court decision that's imminent, sometime this month, about an open carry law in New York. I know you don't have a crystal ball there, but sort of reading the tea leaves of this U.S. Supreme Court, are we seeing just more and more we have more and more lethality and more weapons, we have more and more lax laws to go along with them?
Yeah, I think the future is grim. I think the Supreme Court is not going to help us address all of the kind of various crises we've been discussing this hour. So it doesn't look good on that ruling. And the Heller decision was a landmark decision. And I think it's often because of the effectiveness of the propaganda that we have seen from gun advocacy groups like the NRA, but also the so-called militias, these paramilitary organizations and conservative media. It was a landmark decision because it was the first time, this is in 2008, the first time that the Supreme Court has ever recognized a constitutional right for individuals to private citizens to keep and bear arms. Until the 60s, it was common sense and consensus in the legal community that the Second Amendment was a collective right for militias, state militias, something like what today would be the National Guard, and in lieu of a standing army, that citizens needed a right to weapons in order to participate in state militias in order to defend the state against threats. In 2008, that right was individualized into private citizens and only exacerbated. This was the outcome of lobbying for decades on the part of gun advocacy groups. It is now a constitutionally recognized right, which has now made our task much more difficult. But it was a radical shift in the understanding of the Second Amendment.
I wish we could go on. We have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. Chad Keltzer, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Associate Professor of Philosophy at Lehigh University, Michael Siegel, thank you very much.
Thanks again for having me.
Absolutely. Visiting professor in the Department of Public Health and Community Medicine at Tufts University School of Medicine. To replay this hour and more hours of Radio Times, go to whyy.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscow. Thank you for joining us.